106 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 26th, 1,168 less than a week ago. And the percentage hospitalized has dropped below 10%. They occupy 8.8% of hospital beds. 5,313 new cases were reported on August 26th. The latest positivity rate is 13%.
Don't look so sad, I know it's over, but life goes on, and this old world will keep on turning. Let's just be glad we had some time to spend together. There's no need to watch the bridges that we're burning. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. For the good time, I'll get along. You'll find another, and I'll be here. If you should find you ever need me, don't say a word about tomorrow or forever. There'll be time enough for sadness when you leave me. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. For the good time,
now here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 96 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-80s. Then tomorrow. Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 96 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-80s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Friday, August 28th, 2020. I'm Michael, and here are some of the stories we'll be bringing you this hour. Nearly 600,000 Texans will lose access to a program that prevented electricity shutoffs during the pandemic on October 1st. Texas schools must file weekly reports with state on COVID-19 cases. An analysis from Ross Ramsey, a weather map for Texas's COVID-19 response. The challenges of COVID-19 testing while uninsured in Texas. What a nasal spray vaccine against COVID-19 might do even better than a shot. And from the Texas Tribune, my mask, how this Galveston senior is keeping it rolling in the pandemic. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Texas 2036 website, for Ector County, it's reporting zero active cases. There may not be correct data here. 2.21% deaths as percentage of all cases, 5,779 tests per 100,000, 1,741.8 cases per 100,000. Midland County, 620 active cases, 1.42% deaths as percentage of all cases, 6,137 tests per 100,000, 1,928.2 cases per 100,000. For Texas, from the Texas Tribune, Texas reports more than 12,000 total deaths from coronavirus. 4,489 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 27th. 1,146 less than a week ago. They occupy 8.3% of hospital beds. 5,059 new cases were reported on August 27th. The latest positivity rate is 13%. 12,070 Texans have died as of August 27th. 265 more deaths reported than the day before and 1,277 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $43.01, down 3 cents. And now we'll bring you a few coronavirus briefs. A CDC ensemble forecast projects more than 200,000 coronavirus deaths in the United States by September 19th. The White House has announced the purchase of 150 million rapid COVID-19 tests. Groups representing nearly every public health department called Friday for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to reverse haphazard changes the agency recently made to its public testing advice. The CDC's decision to stop recommending that asymptomatic people who were exposed to the virus get tested is bad policy that costs lives and livelihoods, the groups wrote. A striking rebuke of the premier U.S. health authority by towns and cities across the country. Hurricane Laura's potential impact on COVID-19 infection rates won't be known for days to come. We're basically going to be blind for this week because we'll have to discontinue much of our community-based testing, Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said before the hurricane made landfall. The companies leading the U.S. race for a vaccine have enrolled more than half the people needed for large-scale trials, but are struggling to recruit Black and Hispanic participants. The coronavirus death toll in the United States has surpassed 177,000, while 5,834 cases have been reported. Several U.S. senators are calling for an investigation into the experimental use of hydroxychloroquine in nursing homes. In June, the FDA announced the drug had caused cardiac problems and other serious side effects in COVID-19 patients and revoked its emergency use authorization. Now, here are a few longer articles. 6 feet may not be enough to protect against coronavirus, experts warn. Public health experts are reevaluating guidelines for safe social distancing amid growing evidence that the novel coronavirus can travel farther than 6 feet under certain conditions. A team of infectious disease experts argues in a new analysis published this week in the BMJ that 6 feet protocols are too rigid and are based on outmoded science and observations of different viruses. Other researchers say 6 feet is a start, but only a start, warning that more space is almost always better, especially in poorly ventilated areas indoors. Factors such as air circulation, ventilation, exposure time, crowd density, whether people are wearing face masks, and whether they are silent, speaking, shouting, or singing should all be part of assessing whether 6 feet is sufficient, experts say. From the Texas Tribune, nearly 600,000 Texans will lose access to a program that prevented electricity shutoffs during the pandemic on October 1st. On October 1st, Texans who were previously protected by a state program blocking utility disconnections during the coronavirus pandemic could again be at risk of having their lights shut off because they can't pay their bills, and some could be on the hook for some back payments. The Public Utility Commission, a state utility regulator, enacted the Electricity Relief Program in late March to provide relief to those facing financial insecurity due to the coronavirus, as thousands of Texans lost their jobs due to mandatory shutdowns. The commission's jurisdiction doesn't include parts of the state with city-owned utility companies like Austin, which has a monopoly on electricity services, or regions that use cooperatives. Nearly 595,000 households are being shielded from utility disconnections because of the program. Since March, it's provided more than $30 million in bill payment assistance, partially funded by surcharges added to the other customers' bills that average out to about 50 cents per household per month. Advocates and users criticized the program for being difficult to register for and being advantageous to utility providers rather than consumers. Those using the program were encouraged to pay what they could of their bills at the time, said Andrew Barlow, a spokesperson for the commission. Once the program ends, Barlow said consumers will still be held financially liable and will need to work out payment plans with their energy providers. Customers will only be required to pay what hasn't already been offset by discounts given to energy providers as a result of the program. It'll vary from customer to customer because I think everybody's situation is different, Barlow said. But in essence, the retail electric provider has been maintaining track of how much they owe and how much has been offset. Texans receiving Medicaid or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Plan benefits will still automatically be enrolled in the program until August 31st. Texans receiving unemployment relief are also eligible to register for the program until then. But on October 1st, retail electric providers can start cutting power for non-payment after providing at least 10 days' notice. Barlow said the decision to end the program was based on declining unemployment numbers. As our economy shows signs of rebounding and social services increasingly fill the gaps, it's time to close this chapter and move forward, Commissioner Arthur DeAndre said in a statement. The entities under our purview worked hard to follow our guidance for the duration of the electricity relief program, and I'm confident the competitive energy marketplace will continue benefiting Texans. But Sandy Rollins, executive director of the Texas Tenants Union, said the end of the program is coming too soon. In June, the unemployment rate was down from historic highs seen in April, but at 8%, still more than double what it was before the pandemic began. About 3.3 million Texans have applied for unemployment relief benefits since mid-March. I think it's important for all these agencies to recognize that as much as we want this pandemic to be gone, as sick as we all are of it, it's not gone, Rollins said. It's still here, and people are still suffering, both physically and financially. Now here's, also from the Texas Tribune, Another story, Texas schools must file weekly reports with state on COVID-19 cases. Starting September 8th, Texas will require school districts to file weekly reports on new COVID-19 cases among students, teachers, or staff, state education officials announced Thursday. School administrators must fill out forms, including any new COVID-19 cases their schools were notified of the previous week, whether the cases were contracted on or off campus, and whether the entire campus closed as a result. The reports must include any student, teacher, or staff member who participates in any on-campus activity and has been confirmed to have a COVID-19 infection. School districts that began the school year before September 8th must also report all prior positive cases for this year. The new requirements add an additional task to the plates of school superintendents who are already required by state law to report the details of each positive COVID-19 case to local health officials. State leaders had previously considered requiring school districts to report confirmed cases within 24 hours. The Texas Education Agency and Department of State Health Services will collaborate on collecting and updating the data, which will be published statewide and sorted by district. As the first public schools began reopening their doors this month, many reported staff members and students who arrived with COVID-19 or caught it in athletic practice. Now we're going to move on to our pre-recorded reports. Our first is from the columnist Ross Ramsey. Analysis, a weather map for Texas's COVID-19 response.
This is Ross Ramsey's Unconventional Wisdom, brought to you by Raise Your Hand Texas. Raise Your Hand Texas is strengthening public education for the future, because the future of Texas is in our public schools. Find out more at RaiseYourHandTexas.org.
This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column, a weather map for Texas's COVID-19 response. Let's get this part out of the way. Nobody likes hurricanes, but it's great after all of these months to see state and local governments putting most of the politics aside and working side by side to keep people safe during a hurricane season that has already seen two storms land in Texas. It's a regular routine by now. Somewhere, there's a stash of work shirts with embroidered mayoral and gubernatorial patches to be cracked open when the weather is threatening. Not all of them get their hands dirty, but they look like they could if they wanted to. This is a well-established to-do list. Heck, it's probably laminated by now. That tells everyone in power what their jobs are, who to dispatch, where to ask for money, when to evacuate, where to send supplies and helpers, and when to hold briefings to inform and reassure the public. It would be great to have something like that for pandemics. It's odd to have such a well-oiled machine next to such an unreliable one. Texas has sputtered in the face of hurricanes before. Remember the evacuation hellscape during Hurricane Rita in 2005? But the state learned from it. The evacuations in anticipation of Hurricane Laura this week were smooth and orderly for the most part, without officials at every level of government trying to get a political edge. The novel coronavirus has turned out to be a novel kind of disaster, too, and the response seems completely uninformed by the experiences of floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, and other disasters. Local and state officials have often been at odds, and every response to the disease seems to have an equal and opposite political reaction. Governor Greg Abbott, who generally shines when weather assaults the state, floundered during the first months of the pandemic. First, he gave local officials leeway to determine a proper response. Pretty quickly, he overruled local restrictions, including some he thought were too stringent, and put state restrictions in place. He began easing those much sooner than he had planned, giving up enforcement of his own orders along the way. He let many of the state's crowd-attracting businesses reopen. The payoff was a dramatic rise in COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, along with a body blow to the state's economy. He brought back some of those restrictions, closing bars again and restricting crowd sizes elsewhere. The case and hospitalization numbers are moving in the right direction now, but remain at about the levels they were in early July, when Abbott issued a statewide mask order. Deaths from COVID-19 were counted differently before and after July 27th, making then and now comparisons difficult. but about 1,500 Texans have died every week since that change. Testing has been disorganized and frustratingly incomplete. Contact tracing has been too limited to provide much help. Maybe the current trends are a sign that state officials are better at responding and reacting to the pandemic now. But even Abbott has raised concerns about the effects of reopening public schools and colleges, about how Texans will behave, or not, over the coming Labor Day weekend and hurricanes. If we can continue the downtrends through these three different challenges we're dealing with right now, then we will be taking a look at further openings in the state of Texas, the governor told Houston's KTRK on Wednesday morning. That last worry has merged the state's established response to weather disasters with its uneven response to the pandemic. Many Hurricane Laura evacuees who would normally have been sent to convention centers and arenas in cities far from the coast for food and shelter were sent instead to hotels where social distancing is easier. In the big shelters, the usual array of cots were further apart than normal. And state and local officials worked together, reverting to their weather regimens instead of the politics and intergovernmental bickering that has marked their pandemic responses. Laura might not be the last hurricane of the season to hit Texas. The governor and the mayors and county judges might be donning their disaster wear a few more times this year, maybe even after the storms pass and all of their attention is back on the pandemic. They seem to do better work when they have their work clothes on. This is Ross Ramsey. Thanks for listening.
Now we're going to bring you a series of pre-recorded reports from NPR, starting with what a nasal spray vaccine against COVID-19 might do, even better than a shot.
The goal of a COVID-19 vaccine is to prevent people from getting very sick. It's also important to prevent the spread of the disease. But many vaccines currently being developed don't seem to be able to do that. There are some scientists, though, that think a vaccine in the form of a nasal spray could solve the problem. NPR science correspondent Joe Palka explains.
Most vaccines are given as a shot in the arm, the deltoid muscle to be precise. And for the COVID-19 vaccines under development, it's the same.
The majority of vaccines, in fact, all of the ones that are currently in clinical trials, are delivered via the muscle.
Francis Lund is an immunologist at the University of Alabama, Birmingham.
You will get a systemic response, but you will not get a local response with that.
By systemic response, Lund is talking about generating antibodies that circulate through the blood to all parts of our bodies. This is good. But for a respiratory virus like a coronavirus, the infection typically starts in the nose or throat, and an infection can take hold there before the systemic immunity kicks in. The vaccine might protect you from getting sick, but you still might have virus in your nose that you could spread to others. Lund says by putting a vaccine directly into the nose, you could get another kind of immunity that occurs primarily in the cells lining the nose and throat.
You still get systemic immunity if you deliver it via the intranasal route, so that doesn't go away. And you add a level of immunity that you don't get with the intramuscular vaccine. And that immunity is local.
So the systemic immunity will keep you from getting sick, and the local immunity means it'll be harder for the virus to get a foothold in your nose, if you'll forgive the mixed metaphor. Lund is working with a company called Altimmune to make such a vaccine. Now, you may be thinking, hang on, if we get a vaccine that totally prevents you from getting sick, what does it matter if you can infect others? The vaccine would protect them too. At least, I was wondering that.
That's absolutely good logic.
Michael Diamond is at Washington University. The logic may be good, he says, but there is a practical issue. At least at first, there won't be enough vaccine for everyone.
Even if we had adequate supplies of vaccines, there are two problems. One, some people are not going to take a vaccine.
Surveys say that's true.
And then there's a fragment of the population which just won't mount good responses to a vaccine.
Meaning they may not make antibodies that will protect them. A vaccine that prevents virus spread is desirable, but not always feasible. Diamond is working on a vaccine administered to the nose, which he describes in the journal Cell. Although not common, Diamond says spray vaccines are out there.
There's already a flu vaccine called FluMist, which is used now, and so we expect that the similar technology that's used for existing nasal spray vaccines would be able to be applied to this one.
Complete protection, no infecting others, and no needles. Seems like an idea worth pursuing. Joe Palka, NPR News.
We're now more than 5 months into the coronavirus pandemic, a moment where some schools are reopening, dentists and family doctors are seeing patients again, more businesses are getting back to work, and they're all confronting a familiar problem. N95 masks and other personal protective equipment are still hard to come by, especially for smaller operations without a lot of buying power, NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Here's how the shortage of PPE is affecting one nurse practitioner deep in South Texas, where most days the temperature climbs to nearly 100 degrees. Still, every day, Auralia Martinez and her staff set up a temporary exam room outside her small clinic.
It's been very challenging for me, seeing patients outside in this kind of heat, you know, running my own practice, trying to keep employees, trying to keep them safe.
Martinez and her staff have been treating a lot of COVID patients as infections spike in the Rio Grande Valley. And this is their way of preserving masks and other personal protective equipment. While they sweat in full gear outside, the staffers and other patients inside the clinic aren't exposed and don't need as much PPE.
But I know here in Texas, it has hit us really, really hard, and we don't have enough PPE to go around.
If this sounds familiar, it should. Just like in March, when coronavirus cases spiked for the first time, workers across the country say they still can't find enough PPE. Things like N95 respirator masks, gloves, gowns, thermometers, and more are scarce. Demand has remained high, and prices have too. Dr. Susan Bailey is president of the American Medical Association.
The dramatically increased demand for PPE is not going away anytime soon.
Now Bailey says it's not just hospitals, states, and federal officials all vying for the same PPE.
Churches, schools, businesses, everyone that's trying to reopen needs PPE, and we're all competing for the same small supply.
The AMA has called repeatedly for a massive federal response on the level of the Manhattan Project from World War II. The Trump administration has not done that. Back in the spring, the administration did launch Project Airbridge, which airlifted PPE from overseas before winding down in June, and ordered some domestic manufacturers to ramp up production. Today, the administration insists that complaints about shortages are exaggerated.
You heard all these hysterical reports about doctors on the front lines not being able to get masks.
Here's White House senior advisor Jared Kushner speaking to CNBC this week.
We created Project Airbridge. We were able to bring in from Asia, I think, you know, hundreds of millions of masks. So the federal government has done a lot to stimulate the supply.
The supply crunch has eased for some. Big hospital chains with deep pockets have been able to amass stockpiles of PPE. But smaller buyers say they're still struggling to get what they need.
The PPE shortage, unfortunately, is not going away, and the PPE that is available remains far too expensive for many communities.
Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency physician who teaches at Brown University and the co-founder of Get Us PPE, a nonprofit that was created in March to supply donated PPE to healthcare workers who still need it, especially those working in smaller operations, including assisted living facilities and community health centers that don't have a lot of buying power.
Many manufacturers are asking that you buy 50,000 or 100,000 units of masks or gowns or gloves. A little clinic doesn't need that many units, and they can't afford it. So it really puts PPE out of reach.
Schools that are reopening this fall are also struggling to find enough PPE. Robin Kogan is a school nurse in Camden, New Jersey. She says her own school district is having trouble sourcing protective gear for teachers and staff. And she's heard from school nurses in other cash-strapped districts who've been told to provide their own PPE when classes resume.
We should not be asking our first responders, who are the school nurses, to get their own equipment. To me, that's unconscionable.
Kogan says she's shocked that the PPE shortage has lasted as long as it has. But like many experts, she's worried that this is the new normal. Joel Rose, NPR News.
Instead of walking the convention floor, Democratic delegates are walking from their screen to the fridge and back.
There will be college football this fall, maybe. That is the message this week from some top football schools and conferences. It comes after two powerhouse conferences, the Big Ten and the Pac-12, announced they were canceling their fall seasons because of the coronavirus. NPR's Greg Allen reports how colleges that are planning to play hope to protect the health of their athletes.
Even many hardcore college football fans are skeptical. How can well over 100 people on a typical team train and play without spreading the coronavirus, possibly shutting down the season? This week, three of the top conferences, the SEC, the ACC, and the Big 12, said they have plans this fall to play and do so safely. John Thrasher is president of Florida State University, which is part of the Atlantic Coast Conference.
And what we frankly want to send is a message to some of the other schools that may be teetering on whether or not to play football. We think it's in the best interest of our student athletes for us to play football. We can do it safely, and we can do it productively for them.
For fans, athletes, and the multi-billion-dollar sports entertainment complex built around college football, things looked bleak Tuesday. Two major conferences, the Big Ten and the Pac-12, canceled their fall schedules because of the uncertainty and health risks surrounding the coronavirus. The announcement by the remaining three of the Power Five conferences that they would have a fall season came after athletes began a hashtag We Want to Play movement on social media. At Florida State, wide receiver Keyshawn Helton says he believes training and playing with regular testing and medical protocols in place may be safer than not playing.
You talk about 18 or 22-year-olds, just quarantining at their house, that's unrealistic. There's so many other things that, you know, God are going to go do, and which is not safe. So being here with my team and all of us together is the safest for us.
The college conferences are pushing back the start of their seasons to give them extra time to get ready and perhaps learn from the experiences of other sports. Putting players inside a bubble, like the NBA has done in Orlando, isn't feasible for student athletes who live on campus and have to attend classes. University of Miami coach Manny Diaz believes college football can learn from the English soccer leagues, which resumed play in June without fans. With so much at stake, he believes his athletes will be careful.
They're aware that they've got to keep their bubble small. They understand the value of what a mask does and who that protects. And if you're around people that don't have masks on, you got to find another place to be.
But with all that, there's risk in going ahead with the college football season. One concern that was reportedly a factor in the decision of some conferences to postpone play is new information about a heart condition, myocarditis, that has been linked to the coronavirus. It's an inflammation of the heart that can lead to long-term problems. In announcing its decision to play, the Big 12 Conference said any players who test positive for the coronavirus would receive an EKG, echocardiogram, cardiac MRI, and further heart tests before returning to play. Gabe Feldman, the director of the sports law program at Tulane University in New Orleans, says if the schools are transparent and take the right precautions, he thinks they can play.
Every school and athletic department has to be very clear with all of their athletes about what the risks are and what the unknowns are, and then the athletes have to have a choice.
It's one thing to play, but can there be fans in the stadium? University of Florida Athletic Director Scott Strickland says he hopes so.
We want to be able to have fans, and we hope we're in a position to do that. But, you know, you see this in the NFL. Their season now starts earlier than ours, and there's a lot of NFL teams that still haven't made determinations yet.
That could be the riskiest part of all. Some schools are proposing plans that would limit attendance to 25% of a stadium's capacity, which would still bring together a huge crowd of 20,000 or more cheering, screaming fans. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Millions of Americans who have lost work during this pandemic are making some tough financial choices. The extra $600 a week in federal unemployment money has ended. Eviction moratoriums are expiring. NPR's Chris Arnold reports on what people are doing to survive.
Jane Corsi lives in San Diego and does consulting work for universities. But she says when the pandemic hit, her work suddenly dried up and she's lost her income.
I'm concerned, will I have a place to live?
With the extra $600 a week, she was able to get by. But with that gone now, she says the state benefits alone won't cover her rents and other bills.
You know, I come from New England and we're strong people and we take care of ourselves, but we also need government to help us a little bit. It's that sense that when the money runs out, what do I do?
Right now, there are millions of people asking that question. And this sudden deep recession is forcing many to really upend their lives. What Corsi's doing now, she's 63 years old, and she's moving all the way across the country to Portland, Maine. She's from there and still has family nearby.
I just really this past week decided I can do this. I can get back to Maine.
She's just rented an apartment there. It's cheaper than in California. She's applying for all kinds of jobs, from more professional ones to working in a warehouse for L.L. Bean. And if all else fails, her backup plan is to move in with her parents, though they're in their 90s and live in a small house an hour and a half away from Portland. Still, just to move and get into a new place and be able to pay rent for a while, Corsi's pulled all of her life savings out of her retirement account, about $25,000.
It's really disheartening. You grieve your loss of your financial future and your resources.
Congress gave most struggling homeowners the option to defer mortgage payments for up to a year, but there's no help like that for renters, so they don't get that extra breathing room. And many feel they have no choice but to spend down their life savings. And, of course, many other people don't even have much of any savings at all.
My name is Pam Gunner, Pamela, if I'm in trouble, and I live in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Gunner is a teacher, but was in between jobs when the pandemic hit, so she didn't qualify for unemployment. The school system she'd been applying to froze new hiring, but she kept looking and found a job teaching on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which she's excited about. But that job hasn't started yet, and she's had no income for a couple of months, which has left her with very few options.
I was able to make a payment arrangement with the electric company here, but could not pay the phone bill.
So she has no phone connection right now. That got cut off. She's going to need the internet. Her new school is at least going to start remotely, so she's made sure to keep paying that bill. Like many other Americans who worked their whole lives and never thought they wouldn't be able to afford groceries, Gunner stands in line to get food at a food pantry. And this month, she couldn't make her full rent payment.
So I got home, and hanging on my door was an eviction notice, a 3-day notice to vacate, to either pay it or get out. So I was completely caught off guard. I hadn't gotten emails or phone calls or anything else, you know, that, hey, you need to make sure you get this other half of rent in.
Gunner was able to convince the landlord to be more flexible since she is starting a new job. But for people who are still out of work, both landlord groups and housing advocates are warning of a wave of evictions if Congress doesn't approve more help. They'd like to see a rental assistance plan and another round of those expanded federal unemployment benefits that were helping millions of Americans to stay afloat. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The Food and Drug Administration's mission is to protect public health by assuring the American people of the safety and efficacy of drugs. Now, many scientists are saying that mission has been compromised after a Sunday news conference in which the head of the FDA, Stephen Hahn, stood beside the president and made this false statement about the efficacy of plasma for treating COVID-19.
35% improvement in survival is a pretty substantial clinical benefit. What that means is, if the data continue to pan out, 100 people who are sick with COVID-19, 35 would have been saved because of the administration of plasma.
After many scientists criticized that statement, Hahn corrected himself on Twitter late yesterday and said that criticism was justified. One of those critics is Dr. Eric Topol of the Scripps Translational Research Institute in La Jolla, California, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Ari.
You tweeted at Hahn saying, "Serious mistakes undermine your credibility." How serious is this mistake?
Extremely serious. This is about a treatment that has no proven benefit, and we have the FDA as well as the Secretary of the HHS, the President, all claiming that it's a breakthrough. And I could not be further from the truth. There is no evidence for that.
It's still inaccurate to say 35 of those 100 who would die would be saved by plasma, right?
Right. So that's the next level of the problem. This was based on a Mayo Clinic preprint that has not been peer-reviewed and will not currently, as it stands, hold up to peer review. It's a tortured analysis from 35,000 people who got the convalescent plasma, which drilled down to 1,000 people at Mayo Clinic who got the plasma early, of a certain age. All these cherry-picking subgroups of subgroups, and that's where they came up with this 35%. A careful review of the preprint from which it is based suggested that number would equate to 3 or 4 lives saved out of 100 people who would otherwise die. So basically what it is a 10 times, that's how much exaggeration it is, an order of magnitude 10 times more than the data from an exploratory analysis indicate. This is so extraordinary to take the number of 3 or 4 and to make it into 35.
So you're saying this is an overstatement, the numbers are wrong. He made a mistake and he admitted that mistake. Does that mean that this plasma treatment should not have been approved, is not safe?
Well, I don't think the problem here is the approval on an emergency authorization basis. The problem is the hyperbole and the false statements that are not supported by facts or evidence. So in order to get this straight, Dr. Hahn needs to also talk to the public and say that he erred and that there is no established evidence for survival advantage of convalescent plasma. That has to be determined through randomized trials that are ongoing. And as you know, Ari, you know, millions of people tuned into this breakthrough press conference and have read the outgrowth of it. So this has to get corrected.
You know, Dr. Topol, this administration often makes misleading statements. Why does this one stand out to you?
Well, in two important ways. First of all, it's completely false. There is no evidence to support these statements of a major advance or fulfilling any dream. But the other thing that's especially troubling is the fact that a vaccine could also be given emergency authorization without sufficient data for it working or being safe. And so when politics mixes with science, as is evidenced here, that could be precursor to an even worse situation with the vaccine in imminent weeks.
Eric Topol is Executive Vice President of the Scripps Translational Research Institute in La Jolla, California. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you, Ari.
And we reached out to the FDA for comment. They did not reply by airtime.
For many immigrant Latino communities in the U.S., fears of jeopardizing legal status, underlying health conditions, and longstanding disparities in wealth and health care access complicate efforts to control the pandemic. As NPR's Eric Westervelt reports, one hard-hit neighborhood in California's Marin County illustrates how that's playing out across the nation.
Marin County, just north of San Francisco, is best known as a picturesque gateway to wine country. It's one of the wealthiest counties in America. But the people who scrub the hardwood floors, wash the Teslas, and care for the gardens in Mill Valley, Tiburon, and San Rafael are being devastated by the coronavirus. Latinos comprise 16% of Marin's population, but they make up 75 to 80% of COVID-19 cases in the county. And many of those testing positive live here in the majority Latinx Canal neighborhood.
You know, high risk, high poverty, essential workers facing multiple challenges that other groups are not.
Omar Carrera runs the Canal Alliance, a San Rafael nonprofit that has supported Latinx immigrant communities here for nearly 30 years. The Canal neighborhood is a small, densely populated section of San Rafael packed with multifamily apartment buildings. Carrera says Canal residents were in survival mode well before the pandemic. Then when it hit, he says, the neighborhood was decimated.
The Latinos have been the essential workers for this county before COVID-19, during COVID-19. So poverty, inequities, the jobs that they perform, the housing conditions, all of that create the perfect environment for the virus to spread quickly.
Overall, about 3% of the county's coronavirus tests are coming back positive. But here in the Canal, the positivity rate is averaging 20% and has spiked as high as 40%, says Dr. Matt Willis, Marin County's health director.
The roots of this outbreak go so far beyond our healthcare interventions and are really rooted in how we've organized our economy. People who live in the Canal are 3 times more likely to live in poverty than the rest of Marin County and are 15 times more likely to share a room with 2 or more other people.
Activists in the county are ramping up help, but many say it's not enough. Here and across California, Latinx communities are in crisis from COVID-19. Because many here are undocumented, there's ongoing fear about getting tested and seeking help. Just about everyone in the Canal knows someone who's tested positive. Everyone's afraid they could be next. 18-year-old Zohala Garcia moved here a year ago from a rural village in Guatemala. She works in a bodega in the Canal.
Vivo con mi hermano, como convivimos con ciertas personas en casa. Es difícil mantener la distancia.
I live with my brother and others. There are 5 of us. If someone's positive, it's hard to isolate and keep distance with several people in the house. And it's difficult to stop working because we have bills to pay. and my brother and I have to send money back to our family in Guatemala. If we get sick, it would be catastrophic.
As in many low-income neighborhoods during the pandemic, officials here say they've been hampered by a shortage of testing supplies, trained contact tracing staff, support, and the absence of a coherent national strategy from Washington. Tested in the Canal neighborhood at first was undermined because the company doing them didn't offer online registration in Spanish, and they didn't have enough staff who spoke the language. Then, like most everywhere, test results were taking up to 2 weeks, making the results almost useless. And then there's contact tracing. That's only now ramping up in the Canal, 6 months into the pandemic. Sarah Ryan, who lives in the neighborhood, is a contact investigator with the Canal Alliance.
You have to play part social worker, part therapist, you know, and still kind of find a way to steer them through to answer the medical questions. You know, I had a poor woman who was crying on the phone to me for like an hour because she had lost her father. And she kept telling me life isn't fair, because now she's positive and we're trying to tell her not to go to work. It goes very deep.
The county is working closely with the Canal Alliance. New support here includes new efforts at antibody testing and 20 hotel rooms, free to people in the Canal who've tested positive and need to isolate. 20 rooms for hundreds of positive cases. Early on, California launched a multi-million-dollar effort to add testing in so-called testing deserts, mostly low-income and immigrant communities such as the Canal. That helped, but it wasn't enough. When counties asked the state for more help, the requests were almost always denied. Not enough money, or tracers, or hotel rooms.
We need a lot more hotel rooms. There's no question. The question is, how does that happen?
Dr. Matt Willis says the county is doing the best it can with finite resources.
Yes, it is late. And yes, these problems should have been solved months ago. But we are inheriting a system that is categorically unequipped to manage a problem of this scale and complexity. I'll take, you know, the county will take what it needs to in terms of culpability and blame around that. But I think that ultimately what we really need is a robust national plan. We're left scrambling at the local level to adapt to these problems.
The Canal Alliance's Carrera says Marin's sharp disparities are now coming home to roost in a stark and ugly way.
We have a county that is one of the wealthiest counties in the country. And yet you have these inequities that existed for a long time. And that is the lack of policies. We need resources, but also we need policies to support the people who need the most.
Topping Carrera's wish list, new debates and policies on housing, health, transportation, and education equity. The virus, he says, shows that when you leave any community neglected, we all suffer. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, San Rafael, California.
Black and Latinx people are more likely to get sick and die from COVID-19. That's also true of older people and those with underlying health conditions. These groups are generally among the least likely to be included in vaccine trials, which is important as two companies have announced that they are starting coronavirus vaccine trials that may enroll up to 30,000 people each. Reporter Jonelle Alicia wrote about this for Kaiser Health News and joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Why is it important that these groups that are more likely to be affected by COVID-19 also be represented in trials for a coronavirus vaccine?
Well, the short answer is we want to test a vaccine in the population that's most at risk for serious problems and the population most likely to receive the vaccine. If we don't test in groups that are representative of the community, we won't really know how well a vaccine will actually work.
Well, these trials are taking place all over the country so far. Is there any evidence of whether they will reflect the demographics of those most affected by the virus?
Well, there is some good news. The structure that's been put in place to coordinate these trials is based on four long-standing clinical trial networks, including several that are focused on HIV and AIDS. So they have deep experience and connections with minority and other communities and can draw on those connections for the COVID trials.
What are the hurdles? What's standing in the way?
Well, one of the things that's standing in the way is that there have been NIH rules for more than 25 years calling for minorities to be included in clinical trials. There's a new policy that took effect just last year that would require older adults to be included. And even the FDA's guidelines for conducting these COVID clinical trials call for them to include racial and ethnic minorities, older people, those with underlying conditions. But even that guidance refers to them as non-binding recommendations. And so when I asked the FDA whether they'd refuse to accept vaccine trial data that didn't include diverse people, they said no, they would still accept that data. And so what the experts told me that is that if you don't require it, it won't necessarily happen. There's another factor as well, which is there's this hurdle of minority distrust of the medical system. I mean, there's a long history of disparate, even dangerous treatment of minorities in scientific research and basic care. And many are hesitant to volunteer for a trial because they don't want to become guinea pigs in somebody's research.
So what are the companies that are conducting these vaccine trials telling you?
Well, the companies have to file their demographic goals with the National Institutes for Health, but they aren't required to disclose them publicly. So generally, that means we can only learn about the racial, ethnic, and age makeup after the fact. The companies are saying they want these trials to be diverse. They're saying that they are doing everything they can to make them as diverse as possible. This week, NIH Director Francis Collins noted that they are tracking the enrollment week by week. They're tracking these diversity goals week by week. And he suggested that it might be made publicly available and said it ought to be.
If the trials do not include people representative of the groups most affected by COVID-19, is there a risk that the vaccine won't be as helpful as it could be?
Yeah, researchers are starting out with great intentions. Everyone wants to make sure these trials are inclusive, but they're under this enormous pressure to enroll participants quickly, to accumulate their data, and make sure to hit their internal milestones for development. It can be difficult to recruit and retain minority and older volunteers. It can take more effort, but it's crucial because if we don't include the vast representation of the community in the trials, then we don't really know how it works in this whole population.
That's Jonelle Alicia of Kaiser Health News. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks very much.
Most Americans support stopping immigrants from coming to the U.S., as long as it's in the name of slowing the spread of COVID-19. That's one of the major findings of a new NPR Ipsos poll. But it also found that President Trump's anti-immigration rhetoric has not done much to change public opinion on other policies, like his border wall. Joining me now with the details is NPR's Joel Rose. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Stacey.
Tell us more about this poll.
Well, if you look at the poll results, it's clear that people believe the situation with coronavirus is dire. 2/3 think the U.S. has handled the crisis worse than other countries, and they want dramatic, aggressive action from the top down. There is broad support for requiring masks and also for schools to reopen online instead of in person. And what really surprised us is that more than half of people would support a nationwide order mandating that people stay at home for 2 weeks.
Wow. Joel, you cover immigration here at NPR, and this poll also asked people for their views on immigration. What did it find?
Well, we found broad support for temporary limits on immigration during the pandemic. For example, more than 3/4 of people who responded to this poll, including Democrats and Republicans, support closing the border to non-essential travel. We also found a majority of people are in favor of temporary restrictions on legal immigration, including guest workers and asylum seekers and refugees, although that was largely driven by Republicans, people like Tammy Bunce of Queen Creek, Arizona.
I feel like we need to take care of America first. I think we should be staying at home, and I think other countries should not be coming in until we have the coronavirus under control.
I mean, right there, Tammy Bunce is talking about, obviously, the immediate future, the situation we're in. What did the poll results show us about people's thinking about immigration in the long run?
Well, on that front, it seems like people's views on immigration are remarkably stable. We asked some of the same questions about immigration in this poll that we asked in another poll 2 years ago, and we found that people's feelings have actually not changed very much at all. Mallory Newell is the public affairs director at Ipsos, which conducted both polls.
Americans do want to take steps to limit immigration right now, but that's not because their views on immigration have changed. It's because they want to do everything in their power to contain the spread of COVID-19.
Just like 2 years ago, when we asked these questions, about 70% of people say immigrants are, quote, an important part of American identity. But the public is still deeply divided on other contentious policies. One of them is building President Trump's wall across the southern border. Another one is giving legal status to immigrants who were brought to the country illegally as children, who are often called dreamers. Republicans overwhelmingly side with Trump on those issues. Democrats do not. I talked to another poll respondent, a woman from Houston, Texas. Her name is Jo Lee. She usually votes Democratic, and she supports some restrictions on immigration during coronavirus, but she does not want them to become permanent.
I get right now that we got this pandemic going on, that's fine, but once this calms down, if somebody really wants to come over here and raise their family and be a citizen, let them do that. I don't have a problem with that.
Joel, if we take a look at these respondents' views in the context of the election, Trump has made his immigration crackdown a key part of his argument for re-election. How is that resonating with people in the U.S.?
Frankly, immigration is no longer a top concern, according to our poll. It has been eclipsed by a host of other issues, coronavirus, obviously, but also racial justice, unemployment, political extremism. And immigration has fallen down the list of top concerns. It was fourth 2 years ago. Now it doesn't even crack the top 10. So if President Trump was planning to run on immigration, that strategy may not get as much traction as we might have expected just a few short months ago.
NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. We'll have more on Hurricane Laura and its aftermath as the show continues. For now, we're going to turn to the pandemic. Texas has one of the highest uninsured rates in the nation, and many of those individuals have been met with several challenges trying to get tested for COVID-19. Houston Public Media's Sarah Weller Ernst explores how the state and local governments have struggled to close the gaps.
Since the pandemic started in March, it was clear to government and public health officials that they'd have to do more to make sure people without health insurance could get tested for COVID-19. So, when Congress approved the Family First Coronavirus Response Act,